This week's show is supported by Signature Studio. And I use this myself. If you ever get an email from me, that email signature, it's all Signature Studio. Think about how many emails you send every single day. Each of them an opportunity to compound an impression, tell your story, and position yourself in the minds of the people who matter most. Most people waste this opportunity with a name, maybe a phone number. Signature Studio lets you build an email signature that works for you, featuring live testimonials, your latest podcast episode, a booking link with Calendly, or a rotating banner that stays fresh long after you hit send. It takes minutes to set up, works with Gmail, Outlook, and Apple Mail, and you need no design skills. Your inbox is the most under-leveraged channel in your business. Signature Studio fixes that. Start building for free today at signaturestudio.me.
Welcome to Building Your Leader Brand. This week on the show, Bob is speaking with Robbie Swale.
Whenever we're feeling contraction or stress, the best tool to use is curiosity. What's really going on here? And as we do that, we gradually grow our ability to skillfully move past the things we find most difficult in our work or life. And if we don't use curiosity in those times, then we aren't growing in that kind of way. But when we do, it's not necessarily easy or fun, but more of our potential becomes available.
Hi there, and welcome back to Building Your Leader Brand. My name is Bob Gentle, and every week I speak with incredible people who share their secrets to building, marketing, and monetizing their expertise and the mindset you need for your business to grow and thrive. If you're new to the show, first of all, you're awesome. You're in the right place. You will not regret this. Secondly, take a second to subscribe or follow whichever platform you're on. It's always different. So, this week, I am delighted to welcome my friend Robbie Swale back to the show. Robbie, welcome.
Thanks, Bob. Great to be here again.
So for me, Robbie is the coach's coach. He really is the archetype of an intelligent, suave, insightful, challenging coach. And I really enjoy knowing you. And you've written... You put me to shame. I'm embarrassed by this, but you've written a whole bunch of books. I don't even know how many.
There's five now.
Five. I'm sure you would know the answer.
Yeah.
I'm stumbling over my introductions again. For the listener who's meeting for the first time, who is Robbie Swale? What does he do? Where is he?
Yeah. So the way I think about that at the moment, it'd be fun. So I've been on the show twice before. I didn't go back and listen to those before this show. It'd be fun to go back and listen and see whether I introduce myself in slightly different ways each time. I'm sure I do. The way I think about it at the moment is, I think there's a strong argument this is the hardest time in the history of humanity to lead a group of people or an organization. The speed of change of everything, technology, communication, like mental health crises, all these kinds of things make it really hard. And mostly I think about my work as, how do you help people who are trying to do that grow the skills and capacities that help them do it skillfully without losing themselves in the madness, the whirlwinds that we all deal with. And how I actually do that is through one-to-one leadership and executive coaching, through the books that I've written, and we can talk about those, and through various other programs, including some work for coaches, which is part of what you were referencing there. So I have one of my podcasts is The Coach's Journey, which is a podcast for coaches, which people can, if you happen to be a coach, you can check out. And there's various pieces of work that go alongside that. And I think we talked about that in more detail on this the last time I was on the show, last year sometime or the year before.
So your new book is called The Power to Choose, Finding Calm and Connection in a Complex World. Why this book? What's it about? Who is it for?
I think like all of my books, you know, the real underneath why is about me. So this is a book that I need as much as everybody. This book is the kind of the story of me trying to rumble with the complexity of the world. And it's quite a personal book. It's more personal book than the other ones, really. There's lots of stories from my work and my life in there, as well as stories from clients and that kind of thing. And what it's about really underneath is what I think is, if we think about how difficult it can be to be in the complexity of the modern world, it's about what I think is one of the biggest shifts we can make that helps us deal with and navigate the complexity of the world more skillfully. And that shift is about realizing how we initially see the world and how we think about the world isn't how we have to see it and have to think about it. And in some ways, more than that, the thoughts we think aren't the truth. They're just thoughts we can think. And we can get separate from those thoughts and assumptions and beliefs. And when we do, more choices available to us.
Hmm.
And it's, so it's for, you know, underneath, it's for anyone who's wrestling with those things. But often the people who will get the most out of it are people who are in these kinds of roles where the complexity is very obvious to them. And often it feels like one of the thinkers that I love the metaphor of is a guy called Bob Keegan from Harvard, and he does psychological development research, and he talks about us being in over our heads. So if you feel in your life like you're in over your head, struggling to stay afloat, my hope is that this book, like it has been for me and still is for me, will be some help for that.
I think reflecting on that, the word perspective keeps coming to mind. And what you described there as the way that you see things doesn't have to be the way that you see things. I don't think those are the words you used. Use much more elegant phrasing.
I was actually going to write down your words because that maybe that's how I should describe it from now on. So yeah.
I wouldn't. But we all have our default lens that we see situations through. And I think there are very narrow-minded people who just default to this is the lens, not a lens. And then there are much more broad-minded people who understand that there are many lenses to see things through. Sometimes that can be quite paralyzing because how do I use discrimination? How do I use discernment? And one of the things I like about your book is it does offer a guide to that complexity of the ways that you can see things. For somebody who is more naturally caught up in turmoil, I think those are the kinds of people who are more likely to be overwhelmed or feel like they're in over their head. How do you help shape these other lenses that people can see things through?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it's probably important to say, I think the stage where you, perspectives is a great word to use for this. In a way, what we're talking about, and I mentioned this a bit in the book, you know, underlying what's in the book, it's not front and center because other people have written more about that, is some theories from psychology that really show that as we develop and grow, we gain the ability to hold more perspectives about a situation. Mm. So being somebody who holds really tightly to one, we all have to go through that phase. And then at some point, something happens which forces or encourages us to see, hang on, there could be another way of looking at this. So I think it's a really astute point. And in the book, I think my idea with the book, or the way I look at it now and looked at it as it was being written, is that in there are a set of ways to look at the world, a set of slightly alternative perspectives that most people don't hold, which you can choose to try on through reading the book or through listening to this show. I'm sure we'll talk about some of them. And then when you do that, you can test out, is this actually, maybe this way of looking at the world captures the nuances a little bit more, or maybe it just helps me a little bit more to not feel like I'm overwhelmed, or to create more connection, or to be more skillful in my interactions with people, or to make better choices and discern better.
So in a very practical day-to-day, and I know you address this in the book, and I don't want to reprise the whole book in a podcast interview. So in many respects, I'm going to be leaning on you to suggest ways for the conversation to go in order that the point of the book comes through this conversation, because I think the point of the book is important. But people find themselves in challenging situations. Most books, there is a framework running through the book. Is this a book where you would say there is a clear framework running through the book? And how might people take the sort of 1,000-foot view of that?
Yeah, absolutely it is. And it's trying to, and in the book, a little bit less punctually than, say, my 12-minute method series, which was what we talked about the first time we met, I think, which was on the show. And obviously we know each other way better now. It's a little bit less tight than that because it's trying to tackle a bigger challenge and a broader challenge. But yeah, the crucial idea in there, the crucial framework is there are three key ideas in part one. And they are, first of all, the one we've been talking about. You know, you can choose how you look at the world, and you can choose far more than you think, and it has far, far more far-reaching impacts than you think. It has impacts on the relationships you have, and it has impacts on how you feel when you have a cold, right? It can make a physical difference, or feel like it makes a physical difference to what's going on. So that's the kind of crucial idea on which everything else is built. And then in part one, I also talk about key ways to choose that I've seen make a huge difference, and there's lots of explanation of why in there. One with other people, which is we can shift into coming from this point of view that we could choose to look at other people as though they are people doing their best in the situation that they are in, given the circumstance. Mm-hmm. And when we do that, usually every difficult conversation gets a little bit easier, every conflict dissipates at least slightly, and our kind of resentment and struggle with the world gets less. That would be kind of the second part of the framework. And the third would be, over the long term, whenever we're feeling contraction or stress, the best tool to use is curiosity. What's really going on here? And as we do that, we gradually grow our ability to skillfully move past the things we find most difficult in our work or life. And if we don't use curiosity in those times, then we aren't growing in that kind of way. But when we do, it's not necessarily easy or fun, but more of our potential becomes available. And then in a way, the rest of the book and those chapters is full of my attempt to pull in practical ideas of ways to do that. And then at the end of each chapter, the structure of the book is really at the end of each chapter, I'm trying to boil it down to make it super practical. Here are the 10 questions and thought experiments or mental models that I've offered in this chapter. Here is the further reading that if you want to take this bits further, you can do. Because sometimes when I'm running workshops, I say, and I feel like this with the book, but in the workshop, I'll say, look, I hope it's an entertaining workshop. I hope you enjoy yourself. But I'd sacrifice all of that if in exchange for it, you will do something differently as a result of the time we've got together. And I feel the same about this podcast, you know. Hopefully it will be entertaining and interesting for people. But actually more important than that for me is that people take something from it and actually make their life easier or their impact bigger.
I think one of the things I like about your writing, and when you look at this book on the cover and you read the description, it's very easy to think this is probably quite a cerebral book. Actually, and I was speaking about this earlier today on another interview, that most people these days find it difficult to sit down with an actual book and read it. They have a tendency to fast listen to an audiobook in order to consume information. I think this is a book that you should buy a physical copy of because it's almost a workbook. It's really, really, really pragmatic and practical, as you described, as all your books are. The idea of, I think you describe it as a positivity bias, that when people are experiencing difficulty, that instead of thinking they're being difficult or they're just being challenging, we try and find a positive lens to see their behavior through, that there must be a good reason they're doing this, or they're behaving like this, or I'm experiencing this with this person. I've been thinking about that quite a bit recently, and the change in energy is quite astonishing. Energy is what happens between people, and it's what drives your feelings, and that ultimately is what's going to create what happens next. And it's not natural. We have a negativity bias. It's ferocious. And this intentionality for something so simple as, how can I find a positive way to stand and interpret this behavior, could be world-changing, just as a simple idea.
I totally agree. As you were talking then, I was just remembering when I was first playing with that idea, I lived in London, and so I would get on the Underground. Actually, I don't think this was the Underground. This was just a really busy London commuter train station. And I would spend my whole time frustrated and annoyed with the people around me, jostling me, cutting in front, or walking slowly, like, don't you know, it's London rush hour, like, get a move on. And when I was kind of encountering this idea for the first time, maybe like 12 years ago or something, like you say, the energetic shift was suddenly like, it was substantial and straight away. Mm. And it meant that I, instead of having this pent up frustration, I kind of enjoyed getting through the crowd. And suddenly, you know, this is a little, well, I don't know what we'd call it, but it's like, it did feel like I was just able to connect. So it's why the book is called Finding Connection, right? I was just able to connect with these people going around me in a completely different way, straight away. And you can have these shifts mid-conversation. One of my kind of mentors, mostly from afar, sometimes up close, is a woman called Jennifer Garvey Berger. And in her work, she talks about how, you know, everyone is the hero of their own story. And everyone has a good reason to be doing the things that are annoying you or frustrating you or causing difficulty for you in your life. Now, they may not be as conscious as that, but we have this habit, like you say, of assuming malice, where it may be that none exists. And there's a nice frame that I think I heard from Tim Ferriss in the book, which is, first of all, I heard from Tim Ferriss, which is never assume malice where you can assume incompetence or busyness. I had a manager, this is a story in the book, I had a manager years ago, and I found working with her incredibly difficult, and she kind of ignored my emails. It made life really hard. I assumed she was like, essentially, I was assuming malice. I was assuming she thought my work wasn't very important, that she was kind of deliberately making my life hard, which seems absurd looking back, because one of my other colleagues came in one day and said, have you seen her inbox ever? I just looked over her shoulder and, you know, I can't remember. She had like 5,000 unread emails. And it's like, well, if she's got 5,000 unread emails, things are a little out of control. I mean, it's okay to have unread emails, but 5,000, maybe she's not ignoring me because she thinks my work is pointless, but just because she's got her inboxes out of control because she's not very well organized. And suddenly, like, the whole relationship changes. It's a lot easier to have a good relationship with someone whose inbox is out of control than someone who you assume, based on very little really, thinks that your work is worthless.
I think this is a really interesting topic. I experience this frequently when I'm talking about sales, that when people ghost us, for example, we create a psychological vacuum that there's no information, there's nothing coming back. And so subconsciously, we fill that vacuum with our assumptions. And then we continue that relationship based on this assumed reality. And that reality is very rarely the case. This is a bit of an aside, a bit of a segue. It's nothing to do with the conversation. Kind of is. But when people ghost us in a sales conversation, or when these things are happening by email or social media, we assume it's because they don't want it. Well, I've found that in about 60% of cases, it's actually because they see this as important and they don't feel equipped to deal with it right now. And if we were to treat all our sales approaches as they need it and they want it, rather than how can I sell it to them, the energy we bring to that's quite different. The assumptions we bring to it are quite different. And this comes into almost every relationship, really, that there's always a vacuum between two people, and we can choose to fill it with something positive, or we can choose to fill it with something negative. One of the things that you speak about in the book is noticing our emotions. And I think there are people, and you've kind of described this as we develop, we go from having one fixed perspective to being able to hold multiple perspectives. And I've been challenged on this at times in my life, because I can hold multiple perspectives as equally valid and true. And I got challenged that, Bob, you just should have an opinion. But there are people for whom one truth is the truth. And we all know where that leads. Your book is obviously for people who are a little bit more emotionally and psychologically mature. But have you discovered any ways for helping people move from this fixed perspective to being able to experience having a little bit of insight around there are multiple perspectives? And I think this is a rambling question, but it goes hand in hand with this noticing emotions. I think there are people who think emotions happen to them, and then there are people who understand that emotions happen around them.
Yeah, it's a great kind of inquiry. And yes, absolutely. Yeah, the book, like you say, I would say there's two groups of people for whom the book is, in this way we're talking now, for whom the book is perfect. So it's either for people who are, like you say, already have that emotional, psychological maturity, and you want a whole set of new ideas for different ways to look at things so that you can kind of get more and more skillful really fast. But it's also a great introduction if you've just had the whisper, so the whisper that maybe I am not my emotions. Mm-hmm. There's these people talking about how I'm not my thoughts, but you're still kind of quite in that old way of seeing things, because it's a book about my journey from that to somewhere with greater perspective. So yeah, I think it's good to point to that. And yeah, look, there are many ways to, and the book in a way is a collection of ways to invite people into that shift. Emotions are a great example. You know, it's like, yeah, can we get a little bit of separation from them? Like, ooh, what's, you know, and often it's like the curiosity move. It's like, ooh, I'm really feeling this. Like, what's going on here? another way to do this is, yeah, to just really, it is mostly those inquiries. It's to really start saying, okay, what if there could be another way to look at this thing? You don't have to agree with it. You don't have to change. It can be really valuable and important to have some solid things. Like you say, I'm a little like, it sounds like you are, like life can get pretty tough if you question and doubt everything. And I really mean this. It's like my toughest moments are always when I'm kind of losing a sense of like, what do I actually think here? What is actually grounding me? Because I'm seeing things from too many perspectives. And, you know, of course, that's why I have to write a book about remembering the power to choose, right? Because I need to, sometimes you have to choose something and follow it through. But we can invite people to make these little changes, these little inquiries. What if there's another way to look at this? In the book, I use a really old, what do you call it, optical illusion that some people will have seen. I think it's actually called My Wife and My Mother-in-Law, but I just knew it as the old woman and the young woman. And it's basically a picture. People can Google this if they want to see it. Mm. You know, where one way you look at it, and usually when people first see it, they'll see just one. But most people in the UK, I think, have probably seen it by the time they're an adult. So, but see at some point when you're a child or an adolescent, and you see a young woman or you see an old woman, and you can't understand what people are talking about until someone points out, oh no, look, this bit that is the I can't remember exactly, I haven't got it in front of me, that's the nose of the old woman is actually the curve of the neck of the young woman.
Yeah.
And suddenly, oh, she's looking over her shoulder. Oh, right. And suddenly you can see both. And then you get, this is what life is like, right? It's in the books, it's a metaphor. We have one fixed way of seeing it. We can only see the old woman, and that might be perfect, right? It might just be the truth. It might be a picture of an old woman that you're looking at in your life. Or it's possible that there's a whole nother way of looking at it, which is, in this case, equally true. And then, of course, the question with the optical illusion is it a picture of an old woman or a young woman or neither or both? And actually, like, I don't really know. I guess both and neither at the same time. And that's weird to think about. But actually, lots of things in life are like that. You know, two people looking at the same situation and seeing it completely different. Well, which is it?
I think what I like about this, the book is called The Power to Choose. And I think a lot of people, when they have fixed perspectives, they don't have the power to choose. They're being dictated to by a singular perspective.
Yeah, it's weird. This is a crazy thing to think about. But whenever we're certain about something, we're kind of a victim of that viewpoint. We can't do anything about something we have certainty about. It's just the way things are. Like we're subject to it. It's just happening to us. And that's a weird thing to think.
I think there's nothing wrong with certainty, but did you choose that certainty?
Right.
And I think the image that's emerged as you were speaking about the various exercises is this is a gym for shaping and training the ability to apply discernment and to take charge of the process a little bit so that you are being able to approach, as you said at the beginning of the book, the description, the calm and connection in a complex world. And the complexity of this world can't be overstated, especially if you're in a leadership role. You've got so much certainty that's conflicting, being broadcasted at you from so many different directions, that if you don't have a method for navigating that, you are, and I see this all the time, you're going to be fractured. You're going to find it very difficult to find a center. And this book offers exercises and a gym for being able to own your own space and navigate other people's perspectives in a way that you feel good about, that you can move with confidence, not necessarily certainty, but you chose it.
Yeah.
And I think that's in a personal level, a family level, organizational, and political and global. It's everything from the micro all the way through to the macro.
Yeah, this is why at the start of this conversation, you know, I said this shift that this book is about is one of the big shifts that it can be incredibly powerful to go through. Now, if people aren't running into trouble where they're feeling in over their head sometimes or the stress is rising or whatever it might be, then that's okay. You don't need to read the book. But if you're finding those times when it feels like you're firefighting all the time, where things feel like they're out of control, it's possible that there are some different ways of looking at the situation that will help you discern and move through it more. And usually the truth is, you know, when people come to do work with me, the thing that is encouraging them to make the shift we were talking about in the last question or two is that the world is showing them that it's actually impossible for them to be certain in the way that they were before anymore. Like, it's just that worldview, their way, their perspective, their certainty is kind of breaking because of all the conflicting stuff that's coming their way and their role or whatever it might be. And then the coaching work, for example, tends to be, okay, how do we find the new perspectives and create the little shifts so that the situation doesn't go away and it's not going to get super easy or anything like that, but the way to navigate it becomes clear and the way to navigate it more skillfully becomes clear. And that's what the book's about, really.
An image that's also emerged as you were speaking again is polarization, I think, is the overarching motif of the last decade.
It's interesting, Bob, by the way, I don't think you know this, but you talked about politics, you talked about polarization. When the penultimate draft of this book had 20,000 extra words about politics. And I decided it weakened the message of the book and diluted it too much. And that to make the book work better as a book, it needed to come out. But at some point I'll publish those words because it's one of the places, if we think about the times when people feel, and especially because this book was written over 9 years, which included, you know, started in kind of 2016. So it included the aftermath of Brexit in the UK and all the stuff going on in the US. And so, you know, that if we think about the times when we feel stress, when we feel triggered or contracted, those political conversations, they're significant. And that polarization, again, we become a kind of victim of it. It's absolutely perfect to really back one political organization, but let's check that you're really choosing it for the reasons you think, not that your psychology is running away. And unfortunately, what happens is across all parts of our lives, you know, is that we see the optical illusion, we see it's an old woman, and then we ignore all evidence that it's a young woman, and we accept only evidence into our worldview that it is what we thought it was. And this happens everywhere. So if we think we're rationally choosing our political viewpoint, our polarized position, whether it's in politics, in our marriage, in our relationship with our business partner, we think we're choosing. But in fact, we've just taken our first assumption, then our brain shows us all the evidence for that assumption and gives us reasons to ignore all the evidence against. And if we're running into trouble, say in a relationship with our business partner, because we're at loggerheads about something, then we just want to double check our certainty about that. We want to see it from a different point of view or two so that we can open things up a little and probably create more connection in the relationship, but also probably see things more clearly.
I think if we take the politics angle, one of the things that I am aware of is there are aspects of the right that I think, fair enough. There are aspects of both the extreme left and the extreme right I can say yes to. The problem is that's not also center ground or passivity, but and anybody listening will think, Bob, extreme right wing? No, that's not what I'm talking about. What I am talking about is being able to understand the validity of certain aspects of different things people say. But that not being polarized can almost lead to invalidity at the moment. I guess where I'm getting with this is what I see in the themes through the book is perhaps the polarization that we're experiencing at the moment offers an opportunity and a catalyst for bringing a bit more systematization to what for some people is quite natural, which is being able to understand and embrace different perspectives and find common ground. Well, if that's not common, we need to work on it. We really need to work on it. And you offer a roadmap for how we can approach this. Again, it's not a political book. And I don't think it needs to be, because I don't see this as a political thing. This is a human thing.
Yeah. And it happens everywhere. It definitely happens in politics. There's this lovely, I think it's a video on YouTube that I reference in the book because it's such a great visualization of it. It's this Argentinian consultant called Fred Kaufman. You know, and he's doing a workshop and he puts up his hand against this woman that he's doing the demo with. And he just says, just what do you naturally want to do if I do this? And then he just pushes on her hand a little bit. And straight away, she's like, I want to push back. And that's what happens certainly in politics. You know, when you've got this little polarized thing, somebody's pushing you, it's pushing your buttons. You naturally want to push back. And I think almost everyone listening to this will recognize that impulse, even if they've got more control to choose over it, power to choose over it than they used to. But this happens in all our conversations. It happens in like disagreements with someone in a shop, and it certainly happens in kind of business meetings that we have, especially with colleagues.
It also dovetails naturally with what I know you best for, which is productivity, because the power to choose is not just to choose how you react to relationships, but how you choose what you're going to take action on. Because a lot of people will choose to work on the things that are seemingly urgent rather than the necessarily important. And being able to choose is really, really the thing that's going to change your life if you are a solopreneur, small business owner. It's what's going to change the DNA of your organization if you are the leader. And number one, it's a recipe for self-leadership. But number two, it's also a recipe for understanding the practical choices you make and how you spend your time, i.e. your energy. And if you are leading an organization, that trickles the whole way down the organization. Was that intentional? That sort of natural progression?
Yeah, I mean, look, it is important. It's really important. And I guess there's kind of a couple of things to say here. So one is, yeah, one of the things, if we go back to for some reason, this is what I'm thinking about from the book today, the old woman, young woman, optical illusion. We've got this kind of assumption often that the thing I should be working on, this is what happens for people a lot when it comes to productivity, the thing I should be working on is the thing that is loudest.
Hmm.
And in a simpler time, that was probably a reasonable assumption. You know, if you're running a grocer's shop or a blacksmith's, you know, 500 years ago, like if you've got a customer there who's like desperate for their horseshoe to be fixed, fix the horseshoe. That's like a good business decision. We can't decide in that way anymore. Well, we can. And if it's working fine for you, perfect. But if you think you could go to another level of success, it's worth examining and choosing. For example, a very simple basis, how do I choose which tasks I work on today? And like you say, like a great, you know, I was lucky enough to be taught this when I was like 20, I think, or 21, this idea of urgent versus important. You know, and so that means that ever since I was taught that, that's a different way. So I can assume that I just do the most urgent thing. As soon as someone shows that idea of the dichotomy between those two things, I look at my tasks and my productivity different from then on. Right. Suddenly there's a different lens. I can see that I could look at it as a young woman instead, and actually life works out better for me if I do. And therefore I'm going to do that everywhere I go from then on.
Mm.
And yeah, like you say, that there are lots of ways we can do that. And it really does affect our productivity. And you know, another body of work that I have created in the last couple of years is what I call and we worked together on it when you were coaching me, in fact, is what I call the meaningful productivity blueprint. And people might even notice echoes of your blueprint, roadmap in there if they look at it, because I use that as a starting point. But the ideas in there, yeah, are about, again, they're about how do we think about productivity in a way that is fit for the complexity of the 21st century.
Mm.
And they link together especially neatly. This is a weird back, because we started talking about the book first, this is kind of a weird thing to say, but there's actually two parts of the power to choose. So the meaningful productivity blueprint has, it's got this distinction between time management, which we think is what we need to do, and the things which actually help us, which is the six pillars of meaningful productivity. And you can get this for free at robbieswale.com, and there's a PDF and things. The power to choose is really the super guidebook for two of those pillars. Mm. How do we change our attitudes to make us more productive? And how do we change our relationships to make us more productive? But that key idea, you can choose that first part of it. You can choose how you look at things. That's the, you know, in a way, that's the, what do they say? That's the whole ball game, really.
Yeah. I think for me, this power to choose is so important. I was having a conversation with somebody, and I remember, so we were talking about goals for this coming year, and he gave me a number for what he was hoping to achieve. And I said that, and I gave another number, and that number was a monetary value, just so the listener understands. But I'm not going to say what it was, because that would be crass. But I put a limit on that number for no reason. There was a reason. It was an emotional reaction. And that was something that was happening outside of me. And when I said it, I saw this little emotional rain cloud appearing, and I thought, why did I say that? Why is that rain cloud there? And understanding that I'd put this emotional limit on something that didn't need to be there was so important. And we all do this all the time, but we don't understand that we do it. We don't notice we've done it. So we don't have the power to choose. Yeah. That's been done to us by our own limiting beliefs at the end of the day. And this is why I think going to the gym with a book like this is really important.
Yeah, I can't remember if it's in the book actually much. But there's this idea of that I heard from a woman called Carolyn Coughlin about complexity fitness. She uses that metaphor as well because it's so good. Like, can you essentially go to the gym so that you're fitter for dealing with the kind of complexity that the world throws at you? And look, the emotion, that story you just gave is a great example. So that's that third idea that I talked about towards the start of the conversation, that when we feel a kind of contraction or maybe just a strong emotional reaction, it's good to use curiosity on that. Because sometimes when you do that, what's really going, like you did, what's going on? Why is this rain cloud here? What's it doing? Well, what it's doing is actually creating a lower number. So, maybe the lower number is right, but let's get some power to choose on it, right? What's really going on with that emotion? What's that really about? And there's this story I like to tell. It might be apocryphal, I don't know, of somebody being in a restaurant. It's in the book, being in a restaurant. There's a small restaurant, they're having dinner, and there's this elderly couple on the other side of the restaurant, just across the room. It becomes more and more apparent they're having a really tense dinner until everything goes quiet, just as the woman says to the guy, "It's not about the chicken, Harry. It's about the last 20 years," right? And the reason that everyone laughs at that, it's impossible not to. It's like a fantastic story because we just know the truth of that. We know it in our relationships, but it's in ourselves, right? That kind of reaction, what's it about? It's not about something as simple as naming a goal. It's about what that means for you, or it's about, the limiting belief that you have from somewhere about money or goals or whatever it is. And as soon as we create a little bit more perspective, going back to that word, about this emotion, we get this little bit of space between us and it, which is the space where you can choose. And it's the work that I've been doing for 10 years now with people. They come in, here's the challenge, here's the stuckness. And we just need to see things in some new way, create some new perspectives so that the stuckness kind of just goes away and the way forward becomes clear. And it's powerful. It's powerful inquiry to do, when we feel those emotions or when we notice something like that happening.
So I think we need to move into part two of our conversation. And I honestly need to check before I start recording if people are prepared for this. Did you see the guest primer that suggested that you might want to have three things?
Because I listen to the show every now and again, and so I actually know that you do this now, but I only remembered it like just before this call. So let's see. But let's do it. I've got some things. We got plenty of stuff, I think, from the conversation we've had.
So these are three things that the listener can just go and do. Sometimes it's a podcast people can listen to, a mental model, a book that you think is awesome. It can be literally anything that you think is going to add value to somebody's day. So amplifier number one.
Yeah. Look, we started with it in a way when we started talking about the book. The mental model to try is this, what if this person is just doing their best? What if everyone is just doing their best? Just if because you talked about it, I talked about it, the energetic shift can be so big that if every listener here, this would be just a great, I would love this. This would make me so happy if somebody wrote in and told me, I heard that, and then I did this, and this is what happened, if you go out and instead of getting annoyed with the barista for serving somebody else when they should have served you, you just assume that they're a person doing their best, see what happens. Your business partner who you're always getting annoyed with their emails, what if you just what if this is actually, somebody writing an email with good intentions here? So that would be the mental model to try.
I echo this. I think for me, this is almost habit, but I also have a tube story. So whenever I go to London, I'm the bumbling hick from the country. And I delight in that, specifically on the tube. And I will not go to the tube station without randomly chatting to somebody that I should know better than randomly chatting to. And the delight in people's face, they're startled initially. Why is this guy talking to me? And then they just melt. almost every time. And for me, this just says so much about human beings.
And so much about the world we live in. You know, I've got a client of mine, and we often talk about how people, you know, because his work is about creating connection. And whenever he's doubting it, I'm like, people are desperate for it. They're in the desert, and more connection is what they want. We all want it. We all want to have a lovely conversation with the person in the shop, like the weird hick from the country on the tube. Yeah. You know, like we really want it, but there's all these kind of things and ways and reasons that we don't do that. So yeah, I'm glad you do that.
I think this deserves reinforcement. The title of the book is not just The Power to Choose. And we've focused on the calm and complex. Connection is really what this book is about.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, as you've been talking, you've really brought this out more than I have in this conversation. It's, you know, it's about connection with others, but it's also about connection with yourself. Mm-hmm. To understand yourself so that you can make wise choices and discern wherever you go.
So amplifier number two.
Yeah, again, we touched on it. And because we haven't talked about this on the show before, like at the moment, I did a big piece of work at the end of last year on meaningful productivity. So there's this, and I'm really proud of that work. So you can get this is called the Meaningful Productivity Blueprint. I mentioned it already. You can get it on robbieswale.com. There'll be a Meaningful Productivity button there. And it's a workbook you can work through. It's like a set of ideas that if firefighting is a challenge for you, if you find yourself always never getting through everything, never feeling like you're making a meaningful dint in what you're working on, then it's a set of ideas that will help with that, with some tools, and there's plenty more where that came from. And yeah, it's available for free, and it's just my way of kind of giving something for those people who are in that. You know, again, either they want to take their productivity to a new level, or they're feeling the pressure and stress of being a, you know, especially a leader, but really anyone in the 21st century with a job. You know, it's like the complexities of these roles are really tough, and the ideas in there, some are very complementary to what's in the book, but they're also, some of them are separate and different, and they give a different lens to look at particularly productivity challenges through.
It is really good. You should go and download that. And amplifier number three.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, because you did say book recommendations as well, which is tempting me in all kinds of directions. Yeah. But I think where I'm at, because obviously this will come out later in the year, but we're in this kind of goal setting early January moment that we're in. So I think the tool that I'm thinking that I'm using at the moment, which I use every year, is this idea from Warren Buffett, which I read about in a James Clear blog years ago, and I've been using it for my goal setting every year, which is you make a list of 25 things. All the things you want to achieve in the year, you can go up to 25. And then, and this is the story, is Buffett did this with his, like the pilot of his private jet or something like that. And then the guy comes back next time and he says, okay, I've done it. Like, except they do it for the rest of his career, but I do it for a year. And I usually do it twice a year, January and September. And so you make the list of 25, then you circle the top five. And then the punchline is, Buffett says to the guy, okay, when are you going to work on the top five? And he says, well, I'm going to start straight away. When are you going to work on the rest of them? And the guy says, well, you know, they're important, but they're not as important as the top five. So I'll squeeze them in when I get the chance. I'll do them here and there. And Buffett says, no, they have to become your avoid at all costs list. Because for most people, again, it's not choosing between, so go back to power to choose. It's not choosing between the stuff that's really important and the stuff that's obviously not important. Like, that's not a problem. No one, I mean, almost no one is wasting their time doing completely pointless things. The things that stop you doing the most important things are the quite important things. And if you want to get more done, like if you want to, and the great thing about this is it, for those of us who find it hard to choose, it sneaks up on you as you do the exercise, even when you know the punchline. So that I'm in that at the moment for this year, and it's such a good, it's been very impactful for me in, especially in actually the perception of how productive I am, because I say no to a lot of things I didn't used to say no to. And I still notice all the things I say yes to, all the hours spent watching TV that I don't have to watch, all the, you know, the meetings that I go to, goodness, you know, because I feel like I should, or I want to do someone a favor, not because it's deeply productive, but it's certainly in terms of visible outputs. The reason there's five books and two podcasts and all that kind of thing is because of all the things I didn't do.
So This has been a conversation about perspective shifts and productivity. And you have ended with a mic drop to end all mic drops. You probably don't even realize it. From a productivity perspective, if I look at things like Notion, for example, Notion is a great way to put things that you think are a good idea to do. But the problem is they, once they're in there, they're a thing that needs to get done. It's like any to-do list. Once something's on a to-do list, it's on the to-do list until you delete it. And people don't delete things from to-do lists. Mm-hmm. And for me, this is why almost every productivity system over time caves in on top of me and it becomes an overwhelming mess. The avoid at all costs list is so powerful. My eyes actually watered. I was going to cry when you said that.
I'm going to tell you about when you first do it, if you've never done it before, what I noticed with like 6 to 25, so these are the avoid at all costs list, there are some things on there that you're like, yes, I can say no to this thing. I've now got an excuse. I don't have to do this anymore. Then there are some things that it is really painful and hard to say no to. And I got to say, the first couple of years that I did this, I didn't manage it. You know, like I didn't manage to say no to enough things, or I didn't include, I did things that weren't on the list and didn't achieve the top five. And then over time and practice, and it took years, I got pretty good now. Like the reason the Power to Choose came out, it was pretty painful and it came out, it ended up, I messed up a bit last year. I didn't think it through. It came out pretty much exactly the same time as I was running this series of workshops about meaningful productivity. But at the same time, it came out. Because I said no to a whole bunch of other stuff.
I'm doing this exercise this afternoon. I mean, it's almost instinctive, but to have absolute clarity on these are all the things I think are a good idea. And I can think of 25, almost visualize the list.
Yeah, I got to say, I'm looking for it now. I don't think I've got it handy. One from last year. I actually now use a to-do list template, which forces me to put anything I want to do in a week into a box for one of the top five things or a tiny little box at the bottom for others, so that I really know if I'm getting too off, off message.
There's just so many places to go with this. Robbie, you have been awesome. If people want to get closer to you, if they want to find out more about you, what's the best place?
Everything starts at robbieswale.com. There's links to the books and the Meaningful Productivity Blueprint is there. And social media, I am on LinkedIn. I am on Facebook and Instagram, but the place that I'm active is LinkedIn. And there's a weekly blog people can get, which is always written in 12 minutes, which you have to go back to our first conversation on this show to hear why. And yeah, like I said, there are podcasts in all the podcast places. There's a 12-minute method podcast, which is a one series piece, but it's got loads of ideas and insights about productivity and procrastination in it. And then there's the Coach's Journey, which is long form, sprawling kind of interviews about growing businesses with purpose.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another conversation. I have really, really enjoyed this, and I hope you at home have too. If you have, then you'll probably love the Personal Brand Business Roadmap. 50 pages of everything you need to start, scale, or fix your expert business, 100% free as a gift from me. If you have enjoyed this podcast, again, I would invite you to leave a 5-star review. You heard right, 5, not 4, 3, 2, or 1 review wherever you listen to podcasts. And that's it. Robbie, you've been awesome. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Bob.